good. That's renewed. Hello. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'd like to welcome you to our Healthy Dialogues Luncheon. Many of you have joined us before for these events, and we're very pleased to see such a wonderful turnout today. My name is Dr. Charles Sorensen. I'm the Executive Vice President of Intermountain Healthcare, and on behalf of Intermountain, we'd like to thank you very much for joining us. This event's a continuation of our Healthy Dialogues series. Our goal in this series is to bring distinguished experts from around the country to talk about the components of health care reform and how we can do a better job of delivering high-quality health care and more affordable health care to the people of our state and to our country. As a state, I think most of you know that Utah's in a relatively good position with regard to health care. We have high health care quality, and we have relatively low costs compared to other states. But as all of you here know, we still have much that we could do better. There's much room for improvement, and we've been fortunate to have distinguished people participate over the last year and a half in discussions about how to improve health care here. For too many Utahns, there is no insurance coverage for them, and for many of us, unfortunately, the health care that we receive is not at the national standards of best quality. So we have a long way to go. Past speakers in our Healthy Dialogue series have included Dr. Elliot Fisher, who you recall is a renowned researcher from Dartmouth Medical School, Dr. Mark Chasson, the president of the Joint Commission, Dr. Ken Kaiser, former undersecretary for health in the Clinton administration, then more recently Dr. Bradley Perkins, the chief strategy officer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And today the discussion continues. We're very grateful to have with us today a very distinguished and prominent national leader who has spent a considerable amount of his time and energies looking at medical reform issues. Newt Gingrich, Ph.D., was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1978 and was reelected 10 times from Georgia's 6th Congressional District. As everybody in this room probably knows, Dr. Gingrich was the primary architect of the contract with America that led the Republican Party to retake the House of Representatives in 1994, making Newt the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years. But what you may not know is that since leaving Congress, Newt has devoted most of his time, his considerable energy, and remarkable talent to finding new approaches for the delivery of health care in America. Dr. Gingrich is the founder of the Nonpartisan Center for Health Transformation, which is a collaboration of private and public sector leaders committing to create a 21st century intelligent health system that saves lives and money for all Americans. For the past decade, he has worked with national policy leaders on both sides of the aisle to search out the best approaches to delivering high quality and high value health care. His book, which many of you have seen and read, Saving Lives and Saving Monies, Saving Money, Newt describes his vision of a healthcare system that is centered on the individual, focused on prevention, and innovative in providing care. He has made the case for a market-mediated system that will improve choice and quality while driving down costs. His viewpoint is particularly relevant today as our community, along with many others around the country, looks for ways to improve our healthcare system. We're very glad to have his voice included in our local reform discussion. When Time magazine named Newt the Person of the Year in 1995, they said, "Leaders make things possible. Exceptional leaders make them inevitable." Time magazine continued, "Newt Gingrich belongs in the category of exceptional." Ladies and gentlemen, please join with me in welcoming to Utah, to Salt Lake City, Speaker Newt Gingrich.
Well, let me say, first of all, I'm delighted to be here. And how many of you have seen the article in The Economist about Utah? Have any of you seen this I mean, I don't quite know how you, either the Chamber of Commerce or the governor, got it. You know, it should be an advertisement. I mean, it's basically talks about the fact that you have the lowest unemployment rate in the entire West, and that you keep adding jobs, and that your state government actually has a surplus, which is a term we hope to leave here and go back to Washington tonight carrying with us a translation of that term for people in Washington who have not heard it in recent years. But if you haven't read it, I really recommend it to you very highly. It's a very interesting article and very, very positive from your standpoint. I want to walk you through a couple of big ideas, excuse me, and then I want to really throw it open for a discussion, because with this many community leaders, there's an opportunity to really talk about both health and where the country's going in a way that could be very positive. But I want to start with a sense of change and the scale of change that we have to live through. And maybe the easiest way, if all of you should have this. I used to be a teacher, so I'm addicted to handouts. Partly on the theory that if you fell asleep during my talk later, you could look and see what you thought I might have said. But partially because when you go back to your office or somewhere and you say, well, he kind of said something. If you pull this out, it's a pretty good cheap sheet. If you'll turn to page 5, I'm going to describe in the next few minutes real change, but I want to break it down so that it is understandable and doable and not just a set of ideas. And the first point I want to drive is that we believe at the Center for Health Transformation that you actually have to approach health in 4 parts, and that the sequence is really important, and that most of the current health debate is in the wrong direction. Most of the health debate starts up here with money in box 4, which we think is exactly wrong. Because if all you're talking about is how do I put enough money into the current system nationwide, the correct answer is you can't. Because the current system is designed to expand to absorb the amount of money available. So the current system will be permanently underfunded. On the other hand, if you start at the other end under box 1, we think you can come to a solution in which people live longer, are better off, are more independent, are less expensive, and for 16 or 17% of the gross domestic product, you can find a way to insure all 300 million Americans. Fundamentally different approach. And I want to emphasize, what I want to talk about is fundamentally different. And I want to say that one of the, I'm a little intimidated to be giving this talk here, because one of the people who absolutely is a giant in this area is Brent James. And the work that Brent has done, sitting right down here, the work he has done, not just here, but with some 3,000 alumni scattered across the country who've taken his courses and who've understood his insights, absolutely is the baseline from which the Center for Health Transformation was able to begin developing an entirely new model. Because when you look at the data, which Brent has spent his career doing, the data tells you things that are very different than either the politics or the anecdotes. So where we start is with the individual. If you'll notice, our first box is not finances. Our first box is individual rights, responsibilities, and expectations, and how they behave. And I got to that in part because we early on adopted diabetes as a major focus for a very practical reason. Diabetes is the largest single cost driver of Medicare. Every fourth dollar in Medicare is indirectly affected by diabetes. It's the leading cause of adult blindness. It's a leading cause of amputation of limbs. It's a major cause of kidney dialysis. And it's a major cause of heart disease. It's a greatly underestimated disease because it is quiet, it's inconspicuous, and its primary effects are something else happening to you, like you lose your feet. But you don't think of that as diabetes. So when I began working on diabetes, which I first did as Speaker of the House, it's really obvious. It doesn't take 10 minutes. It doesn't take 10 minutes talking to an expert before you realize diabetes absolutely requires that the patient be involved. It is impossible to manage diabetes through the doctor and the nurse. They can educate, they can encourage, they can teach, but they can't do it. It's not physically doable. And you suddenly begin to realize, oh, and by the way, Governor Mike Huckabee is one of the best in advocating this because he's lived it. If I can catch you before you're diabetic and get you to change two habits, how much you eat and how much you exercise, I can substantially change your life. And so we had a meeting on diabetes and obesity this week, and I haven't asked anybody with Brent or Intermountain about this, but this is one of the things we came up with, is that it's possible that we ought to have two national goals. And it's the first is for everybody, and the second one is for people who are overweight. The first goal is 30 minutes, 5 days a week. If you'll just go walk 30 minutes, 5 days a week, you will substantially improve your health status. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your age. If you just get in a rhythm of figuring out, I'm going to walk for at least 30 minutes every day. The effect of that over your lifetime is breathtaking. And I have a very simple model. You decide whether you want to spend the time exercising or spend the same amount of time in a hospital bed. Because you're going to do one or the other. And you decide whether you want to end your life living independently or end your life in a nursing home. And then you get to decide every day which person you are. But now we have a real contract. If you say to me, no, I don't want to exercise, that's not who I am, fine. Then later on when you end up in a nursing home, don't complain. You put yourself there. But it's that simple. It's a different contract. The other one, which is actually only for people who are overweight, of which I am one, is you got to lose at least 10 pounds. If every American who is overweight lost 10 pounds, the total effect on the population at large would be substantial in the terms of the number who got diabetes. Now, the reason I cite this is these are broad, generic things you can say to everybody that affects their individual behavior. But they only occur if one individual decides to do it. The person who's, I think, done the most interesting job of this so far is Mick Cornett, who is the mayor of Oklahoma City, who got up at the beginning of the year and decided he'd been 40 pounds overweight his entire life. And like me, he'd spent his entire life, you know, looking for a beer and ice cream diet that worked. And it had never helped. And so he decided the only way he would lose 40 pounds and keep it off is if he got the entire city to join him. And so he launched a project that's computerized and it's been heavily publicized in Oklahoma City. And as of September 1, they had lost 176,000 pounds together. And the restaurants now have the Mick Cornett menu, and they have a whole series of things. And they have walks on Saturday, and they have people who are actively involved, and they have bicycling downtown. But it took a dynamic, charismatic mayor who just decided he would live out his personal experiences with the whole town. And it's actually caught on in a very exciting way. And people now have their own health record online. And in terms of they put in their own weight and they put in their what they've been eating. And it's a very interesting, fun project. But start with this first thing. And the reason we got to this, when we first started the center, I knew I wanted it to be the center for health transformation, not the center for health care. Because I knew that I wanted health care to be a subset of health. And I wanted to emphasize keeping you healthy before I talked about how to improve the delivery system if you needed care. But I was still inside the traditional pattern. And so in our very early stages, we described health, we described a patient-centered system. Even though I said I wanted to focus on health, I still ended up using language that comes out of healthcare. And I was in Lausanne at the research laboratories of Nestle's, which is the largest food company in the world, and they have a larger research budget for nutrition than the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. And so I had like 150 or 160 nutrition scientists, most of them PhDs, and we were talking and I was showing them our model, and they stopped me. And they said, patient is exactly wrong. You have to focus on the individual in their pre-patient status. And Nestle's had a very simple model. They said there are three things you want to affect. And again, this you may have certain advantages in this community over some other parts of the country. And Gallup Healthways now have a joint project where they're doing massive polling. They're doing 1,000 sample a day on health 365 days a year, and they're presently going to be able to tell you which communities are happier and which communities are angrier and which communities have better health and which communities have worse health. My hunch is you're going to turn out to be a pretty desirable place to live in a variety of ways. But this was the Nestle model, that you affect three things. Two of them I've already mentioned. Attitude, activity, nutrition. They said, if we can get people to have the right attitude, the right activity, and the right nutrition, it is amazing how much healthier they are. And one of their models, for example, is people who smile are healthier, which is technically true. Smiling leads to endorphins. It strengthens your immune system. So the next time you see somebody frowning, say, don't be sick. But it goes a stage further. It led me to conclude that 21st century medicine would actually have four components. It would be physical, which is what it started in the 19th and early 20th century. It would be physical, mental, it would be social, and it would be spiritual. And that actually people by the middle of the century will be getting checkups in which they think about all four components of their life, because all four components actually change the quality of your outcome. Women who have group support are three times as likely to survive breast cancer as women who are isolated. It's a Johns Hopkins study. Women who go to Silver Sneakers, which is a HMO Medicare product where you get together three times a week at a gymnasium when it's not being used very much, and you exercise together, women who belong to Silver Sneakers have a 62% decline in depression medication. And it turns out that women, when they're isolated, women are much more social than men. Men basically don't notice each other very often and wonder why they're there when they do notice them. But women actually like being with other people. It's a very strange example of how fundamentally different we are. And it turns out that older women who are isolated get depressed. Now, I mean, I'm not talking about biochemical depression, which my mother had, and she was bipolar, and I have a sister who's bipolar. I understand biochemical depression. That's a mental problem. But it turned out that most of the women in Silver Sneakers didn't have a mental problem. They had a social problem. They were lonely. And being lonely, they were depressed. And when they began exercising together, they made friends. And so after they got done exercising, they'd have coffee. Then they'd go home and call each other. And then they would get together the next day to talk about the fact that they're going to exercise the day after. And then they'd get together to exercise and they'd have coffee. And then they'd go shopping together. All of a sudden, they were too busy to be depressed. Fundamentally different model. But what I'm suggesting to you is, as a community, you could take these four goals and you could say, this is very different than parity. I believe we ought to talk about inclusion, that really effective checkups ought to check your social state, your spiritual state, your mental state, and your physical state, because they all interact. One of the biggest surprises that Gallup is coming up with is the level of depression there is in the country. That when you go on and you check with people, and you can really see people who have a hard time working well because they can't focus. Because they genuinely are depressed. And again, this is not necessarily a medication problem. And you've got to be very careful how you analyze it. But it leads you to think, as the second box, which is it leads you to think as a community, what is it we're doing to make it possible for people to have the right attitude, the right activity, and the right nutrition? Now, let me be quite clear about this. I believe in meddling. I mean, if we're going to talk about health, you are going to meddle. Otherwise, what's the point? So I'll give you a couple examples. And I don't actually know what Utah state law is. I believe in K through 12, 5 day a week physical education that's real. That is actual physical activity. I believe you ought to be very careful about what kind of stuff you provide in school before 5 o'clock, because you have no reason to give kids junk food at a time when you say you're worried about obesity and diabetes. I believe that you ought to rethink the school lunch and school breakfast program, which may well be a Washington problem, but it would be really helpful to have some place like Utah that told us how we ought to redo it. I also, I'm going to really meddle, I believe that you ought to reestablish the idea that if you live within a mile of school, you should walk. I would redirect some of the school bus money into sidewalks. I would actually invent something like raincoats. You know, I am old enough, I actually walked in the snow to school. I know this is old-fashioned, bizarre conversation stuff. And I would urge mothers, don't make up for the school bus program by taking the minivan to drive your kid 1 mile. Because in the long run, children who walk in the rain will be healthier than children who don't walk. Now, that's just a statistical fact. I'm trying to give you a flavor here of how you would think about these things. The third, and then by the way, you have one of the great advantages because you have so many beautiful outdoors here. But I can't imagine how a state could have a greater opportunity to create the community opportunities for activity and to try to figure out how to get every single person in the community engaged when you just think of the sheer physical beauty you have here. And notice, even with a system as good as Intermountain, what I'm suggesting is that you're now in an opportunity to think about the total community and to think about the individuals long before they become a patient. And to think about what's the right relationships and what's the right patterning and how do we make this happen. Now, if you take care of the contract with the individual, and I'm pretty relentless about this. I think, for example, you ought to weigh every school child 3 times a year. But I'm for being cheap and practical. Go to Costco or to Walmart or to Target. Buy scales that are digital. Put them in homeroom. They don't have to be scientifically measured. What you're looking for is not 108 versus 109. You're looking for 108 versus 208. Now, part of the reason we designed this model is I first said this near Reynolds Plantation, Georgia, in talking to 3 small rural counties, and we were talking about teenage diabetes and all that, and I looked around and I suddenly realized, these 3 counties, this is not a public policy problem. This is a management problem. The total number of kids they have in 7th grade is definable. In 7th grade, they're still all in school. And I said, why don't you go to Walmart, buy scales, put them in homeroom, weigh them 3 times a year. And one of the people said, wait a second. I mean, you can't tell their parents. You can't tell. I don't quite understand what I'm doing here. You can't tell their parents that they're overweight. I said, let me get this straight. You have a social contract. We have a child who's clearly in danger of becoming diabetic. You can't tell the parent that they need to change the child's behavior. But when the child needs kidney dialysis, the parent's going to be able to bring him to your county and say to you, take care of my child for the rest of their life. And you think you're going to survive with this contract? And I realized that we need to have a really fundamental conversation as a people. This was before the recent housing meltdown, which I will describe to you in very simple language. Do not adopt government policies that encourage people who can't afford a house to get into a house they can't afford, so you're shocked when they go bankrupt at having been overextended, and then when enough people go bankrupt simultaneously, the institution which stupidly loaned them the money they should never have been loaned finds it's in really big trouble, and then you're all shocked. What did you think was going to happen? But it's time we go back and have this serious conversation. Now, I'm going to meddle for a minute and go way out of health because I can't resist because I have too many opinion leaders here in one place, and I want to give all of you an assignment. I mentioned this to the governor earlier. I would like all of you to go to a website called 2mminutes.com. And that stands for 2 million minutes. And the reason I want you to go to that website is the 2 million minutes. This is, I don't quite get what I get very concerned. I'm right. If you guys are all right, I'll just slow down every time the thing goes out. 2 million minutes is a movie that shows you 2 Indian high school students, 2 Chinese high school students, and 2 American high school students, and 4 years of high school is 2 million minutes. When you have finished seeing that movie, you will understand that the United States is like a country eagerly preparing for the 1956 Olympics, none of which scores will get a medal in 2012. And that the level of fundamental change we're going to need in our education system, in our expectations of ourselves, if we're going to remain the most competitive country in the world, is truly historic and staggering. Now, I cite that to come back to health for a second. You are in a world market. You're up against an enormous scale of scientific change. Our estimate is that there will be 4 to 7 times more science in the next 25 years than in the last 25. And that those are literal numbers. That is, there are more scientists alive today than in all of previous human history. They get better computers and better instruments every year. They're connected by cell phone and email, and they are then connected to the world market through venture capital and licensing and royalties. And the result is you're going to have wave after wave after wave of new technology. Now, what that's going to mean is when you combine China and India, who are facts, they're not a problem. It is a fact that there are 1,300,000,000 Chinese. It's a fact that there are 1 billion Indians. They all want to come and play. They all think they've been endowed by their creator with the right to pursue happiness. And they're all rolling up their sleeves to pursue it. So you take the scale of scientific change, a world market with 2 massive competitors, and unless we are prepared to continually develop better outcomes at lower cost, we're going to have a big problem. And so you can't say to me, health costs are going to go up forever, because I'll guarantee you, the world market won't tolerate it. And if we don't find better solutions through better practices, we'll go to rationing, because we will go broke otherwise. Now, I'm deeply opposed to rationing. So I have a model, which I'm going to get to in a second, which I think is dramatically better. But you're going to get real change because you cannot, just as we couldn't sustain Wall Street and we couldn't sustain housing, you cannot sustain consistently breaking the economic rules without eventually paying a huge price. And you can't have 1 or 2 sectors. The other one that's going to hit, by the way, is higher education. You cannot have sectors that cheerfully just get more and more and more expensive while there is downward pricing pressure in the entire society. So you've got to constantly look at it. One of the reasons I always talk to Brent, one of the reasons I come out and look at Intermountain is arguably the most productive single health system in the United States. It is arguably 20% more productive than Mayo, which has historically been considered one of the most effective places. And this is a result of a 40-year process that Homer Winston began by bringing together medicine and computing and actually doing it the right way, which is medicine drove computing, not the opposite. Now, so you've got a model here, but this model doesn't exist in much of the country. And you look at the difference of pricing here and pricing in Miami, or pricing in Los Angeles, or pricing in New York City, you'll begin to understand how big the gap is going to be and how much change is coming in health. Now, let me give you a simple model which you can go and look at. If you go to YouTube, you can pull up a very simple 3.5-minute video that is the model of the scale of change we're going to have. It is called FedEx versus Federal Bureaucracy. It's part of a speech I gave at the American Enterprise Institute last year. About 1,500,000 people have seen it so far. It's a very simple model. How many of you have ever gone online to check where a package was at UPS or FedEx? Just raise your hand. So virtually universal, right? Now, I want to stop here for a second to make a point. This is not a theory. Because you'll read occasionally, Gingrich has interesting ideas, but after all, we have to be practical. Which usually means selling out on the future and doing something truly stupid. So it is a fact that if you have an entrepreneurial company that rewards achievement, punishes failure, focuses on the customer, lives in a market, invests heavily in information technology, that you can track 23 million packages a day while they're moving. 15 million at UPS, 8 million at FedEx. UPS says that a UPS truck has more computing power than the Apollo 13 lunar lander. And that when the average, when the UPS delivery person walks in the average doctor's office, they double the amount of computing power by what they're carrying on their belt. Now, in my book, Real Change, which was subtitled From the World That Fails to the World That Works, I cited FedEx and UPS as examples of the world that works. So accurate, so convenient, that they allow you to go in and look at your own single, your single package out of 23 million and locate it and know where it is. I mean, if you think about it, it's almost a miracle. It's a stunning technical achievement. That's the world that works. Now let's take the world that fails. For example, the federal government, which today cannot find between 10 and 20 million people who are here illegally, even if they're sitting still. So one of my policy proposals has been that we spend about $200 million and we send a package to every person who's here illegally. Now, that's obviously hyperbole, but I'm trying to make a deeper point. Think about the scale difference in accuracy, in systems thinking, in use of information technology, creating convenience, efficiency, productivity, reliability. And now take that and apply it across the whole system. One example. How many of you own a cell phone with a camera? Just raise your hand. Almost universal, right? Yet we do not, to the best of my knowledge, in a single state, have the following simple model. In a long-term care facility, if grandmother suddenly has a crisis at 2 in the morning, the correct thing should be for the attendant to promptly take grandmother's motion picture, send it to a 24/7 doctor center that has been appropriately protected by the state, so that the doctor can actually look at the information, talk to the attendant, look at the record, and determine whether or not grandmother can be helped on site in the nursing home without getting in an ambulance to go to the hospital. Now we know, as a matter of data, that moving grandmother in her 80s and 90s is the worst single thing you can do because it inevitably disorients her. And it inevitably shortens her life. Even if it's necessary, it's not good. We also know that because very few long-term care facilities can get access to a doctor, and no doctor who has any concern about malpractice is going to practice medicine over the phone, we have had zero use of instantaneous information flow in an organized manner. Yet Utah could adopt a law, create a single center, which is all you need for a state this size, build it off the VisiQ intensive care electronic model, and you would dramatically reduce the number of emergency room visits by older people from nursing homes, and you would lengthen their life and improve the quality. We also know this is true because, in fact, United Health has a product which does exactly that. And where it's in use, it reduces emergency rooms, it reduces medication, and the people who actually get to know the patient and actually have an electronic health record for the patient, it's much better, it's a dramatically better program. In fact, I was just with, we have an Alzheimer's study group at our center, and I was just with former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, whose husband has Alzheimer's, and she was talking about the extraordinary effect. It's called Evercare, and they have one Evercare Alzheimer's unit in the country, and that unit her husband happens to be in. And she said, it's amazing how much better his care has been, because they actually have a system of knowing who he is. And they have a system of knowing what his unique problems are, because every person's unique. So I'm just giving that as an example. All of you have a cell phone with a camera. To the best of my knowledge, there's not a single place in the country yet which has adapted that as a health tool. Because after all, it wasn't individually designed by a consulting firm at stunningly high cost to be sold for $11,000 a copy. It just exists. It's ubiquitous. It's part of who we are. Which gets us to the third level, which is this whole notion of how do you get to a modern health system? And I have a proposal which really does in part grow out of the work that Brenna's done And we had him back east last year, and he met with a number of members of Congress and a number of other people, and really trying to begin to move an educational experience. We want to create health-based health reform. It's a very simple model. Imagine you could identify the 10 best hospitals in the country at avoiding hospital-induced infection. And then you could identify the 10 worst hospitals in the country at giving you a hospital infection. And look at the delta of difference in what happens to people between the 10 best, where very, very few people get an additional infection, and the 10 worst, where my guess is every third person gets an infection. And then you realize, by the way, this is all management and culture. It's not very expensive to not have infections. It just takes a very disciplined approach. Now, what if we could take the worst hospitals and migrate them up to being comparable to the best? It would actually save us an enormous amount of pain. It would improve the health outcome of the patients. And it would save a lot of money. But we today have zero mechanisms for doing this. It's all random behavior. And in fact, the hospital associations, on behalf of their dumbest members, bitterly fight the idea of reporting the data. I mean, Congressman Tim Murphy has a bill that would actually have hospital infections reported by hospitals. And deep opposition. I mean, what if people knew that we gave you additional diseases for free? And so start with that kind of a model. If you go around the country, you start discovering that there are centers of excellence that are brilliant. I mentioned the work that Intermountain's done. The work that you see at Gunderson Lutheran in La Crosse, Wisconsin, the work that's done at Mayo. I mean, but you can go around and you can find lots of great places. The Northwest Inland Health System in Spokane, Washington, has as good an information technology base as anybody in the country, and does things like distance pharmacy in a way that ought to be the routine for every state that has large rural areas with very, very small rural hospitals. And so you could go around and you could begin to aggregate. And you wouldn't want the best, because that's too hard and you get in a big fight. You just want the top 10%. You want to say, look, if you're in the top 10%, we want you to be in a position to A, talk to the news media and come testify to the Congress. And one of the things I'm going to try to get done in January is to actually have hearings of success. That is, rather than talk about all the problems we have, what if we brought in the people who are doing the right things? And it's one of the great differences. One of the last stands of the old America is the sports page. I don't know if any of you have ever thought about this. But on sports pages, we very often interview winning coaches. You know, whereas in the political page, we tend to interview losers. So if the sports page was written by the political reporter, they would find the worst NFL football coach. And they'd have a lengthy interview about, do you feel bad at the end of each game? And the coach would want to be a sympathetic figure so he could be invited on Oprah. And he'd say, well, it's been pretty traumatic for my family this year, and they find it pretty hard to watch the fans booing me at every game. But I've decided, why learn football? It's just one of those extra things. I like coaching from a sympathetic heart. You know, you just wouldn't do that. But notice how we tend to do our congressional hearings. Let's find somebody congressman can yell at, which is not very educational, frankly. Or let's find somebody who'll tell us, I have a problem, which may be true, but so what's your solution? And so what I want to do is just the opposite. I want to see if we can, next January, start a series of hearings where we find around the country the best of the best. And we bring them in. And in a variety of different areas, they say, this is how we deliver better care at lower cost. These are the procedures that actually work. Here's what our record is like. Here's how somebody else could learn how to do it. And all of a sudden, you could then ask the question, gosh, should the largest single purchaser of health in America, namely the federal government, have an active interest in migrating people in the right direction? Now, let me give you an example of one of the more grotesque things that will immediately pop out of this. We have a level of fraud in this country that is breathtaking. New York Times did a four-part series on Medicaid in New York State and discovered their estimate is the New York State minimum is 10% pure fraud. Now, I'm not talking about upcoding and arguing over judgment and all the things you get involved in. I'm talking about a doctor who filed 982 procedures in one day. Or a doctor's office, a dental office rather, in Brooklyn that had a person who stood out front who said, if you will loan us your Medicaid card for 30 seconds, we'll give you a free DVD player. Now, New York is a world of its own. So go to Miami. My personal guess is that 60% of the money the federal government sends to Dade and Broward counties for HIV/AIDS transfusion is fraud. 60%. 2 years ago, there was a state federal task force which raided 17 centers and closed all of them down. Five of the 17, these were HIV/AIDS transfusion centers. Five of the 17 were, in fact, pizza parlors. And they had figured out if you filled out the forms and you sent them in, the federal government would send you money. And they thought, why should we deny the federal government? If they're that determined to send us money, shouldn't we participate? Isn't it our duty as citizens? You may think I'm making this is all true. I'm not making any of this up. Now, what does that mean? It means if you want to modernize the system, you only want to go to an electronic health record because with electronic data, you can track the flow of money in real time and you spot the outliers in real time. We have a member of our center called TSIS, and TSIS is one of the two largest back rooms for credit cards in the country. Their goal is 0.2% in terms of fraud. So they want better than 99.8% of their payments to be accurate and to be honest. And they have all sorts of expert systems that look for outliers, that look for things that can't be right, and that check them literally during the day while they're happening. You never catch up with crooks in a paper-based system because they can move faster than the auditors. So let's assume the federal government can't possibly be as efficient as a private sector company. Let's assume it's 10 times worse. If it is 10 times worse, that means in New York State alone, you save $3.9 billion a year in Medicaid alone. Now, why does that matter? It matters because you watch. Next year, if they have a budget problem, they're going to cut everybody. So if you're really efficient and you're really honest and you're really doing a great job, you're going to get hit along with the crook. And that's fundamentally wrong. I mean, first of all, it punishes everybody who's trying to be really good. And sometimes the way they do the hits, it actually hurts you more if you're really efficient. Virginia Mason is a medical system in Washington State, which has for the last 7 years been going to Japan and studying the Toyota production system. They take 20 people at a time. And they follow the Toyota model of taking out the waste. And what they discovered was that when they took out the waste, They were taking out the billing points. And they suddenly realized if they didn't do the things that were wasteful, they couldn't bill for enough to stay in business. And they had to actually sit down with their private sector providers and or payers and say to them, we got to figure out a new contract because if we only bill you on the transactions and we eliminate the transactions that are unnecessary, we will literally not be able to provide the services. Now that's fundamentally wrong. So part of what has to happen is you have to realign the payment system so you are paying for the behaviors you want. So in an ideal world, you would pay more to the hospital that had the fewest infections and less to the hospital that had the most infections. And you would reward excellence, which is precisely what UPS and FedEx do. And you would say, if you're a doctor who really takes great care of your diabetics and they don't end up needing kidney dialysis, you ought to get a higher fee because you just saved us a huge amount of money. Now, that's how big the difference is. And so I think that's the sort of thing. Now, I can just use this if this is unreliable. Well, that one's equally good. I want to give you this so you don't have feedback. Otherwise, it's very good. now? Is this working? Okay, now we've moved to one that doesn't work at all. Which certainly has a reliability factor that's very high. What do you think?
Okay. The governor's telling me what a center of high tech you guys are now. So the point I'm driving at is, what you want to do is fundamentally rethink the system, at least as deeply as FedEx versus federal bureaucracy. And you want to figure out, what are the outcomes you want? Therefore, what is it you're paying the system to do? And how do you keep track of it accurately? And you want the accuracy, ultimately it has to be electronic. If it is not electronic, it is not possible to maintain the data you need. And so I think inevitably we're going to migrate to an electronic health system. Last year we produced a book called Paper Kills, which is essentially an argument that literally if you're getting a paper prescription, you have a much higher likelihood of having a medication error than if you have an electronic prescription. And we helped write a bill which passed this year, which starting next year, doctors get 2% more on their Medicare payments if they go to electronic prescribing. In order to incentivize the transition to electronic prescribing, because we think it's a very useful first step towards where we need to get. In addition, I would argue, if you look at how the Toyota production system really works, you look at any other quality system based on Deming or any of that kind of model, if you can't gather the data, you can't know what's effective. And it's very hard to gather the data in a paper-based system. But if you can gather the data electronically, you can begin to figure out, A, what works, B, who's not doing it very well. And the goal here is not to punish those who aren't doing it well. The goal here is to coach them so that they can learn what works so you literally migrate the entire standard up. A few years back, I had the head of Mayo came to see me and said that he thought they did about 70% of the stuff they did right. And that his hunch was the national average was actually about 50. And that he'd like to move the whole country up to the 70 and get Mayo up to 80. Now, it's a mythical way of thinking about it, but it's a useful way to think about it. Our goal here, you know, if you look at the aviation system, I used to be the ranking member on the aviation subcommittee. And I represented the Atlanta airport for 20 years. Our goal in aviation is to get every pilot up to a minimum. And we work very hard at this. And we try to get every airplane up to a minimum. And we try to get all the maintenance standards up to a minimum. And all that requires a lot of data. But it means on a worldwide basis, if we find something wrong with a particular airplane, every single airplane of that type in the world, within 48 to 72 hours, has been notified that it has to be fixed. Now you compare that to the Institute of Medicine report that it takes up to 17 years for a new best practice to get to the average doctor. It's fundamentally wrong. And basically what it means is we really value your life in an airplane much more than we value your life in the health system. And it's just fundamentally wrong. So we do think, in addition to the individual, in addition to the community, you want to move to a 21st century intelligent health system that can deliver personalized care in an effective way using the most modern information systems and using the constant process of having a health-based reform that drives towards more and more high-quality outcomes on a regular basis. The last piece, frankly, is financing. And I think if you do the first three right, you have more than enough money. In fact, you probably have enough money that in the long run, you'll be surprised how much falls out of the system by having these kind of reforms. I believe we want to have as a goal every American having health insurance. And I believe we want to find a way to frankly, cross-subsidize the very poor on a practical basis, which is we're going to be a much healthier country with much greater productivity if everybody's part of the health system, if everybody has preventive care and wellness, if everybody is able to walk into an emergency room or be in a car wreck and end up in an emergency room or have a heart attack and end up in an emergency room and have an accurate electronic medical record. So I do want to see a system nationwide of information, and I do want to see every American with insurance. I'll make two side points about that. The first is I want it to be a 300 million payer system in which you have your insurance, not a single payer system. I can't imagine anything more likely to cripple the future of this country in health terms than to go to a Washington-based bureaucratic single-payer model, which I think would absolutely be the end of all innovation and would lead to the level of decay we laugh about in the FedEx versus federal bureaucracy model. Second, I'm willing to acknowledge libertarians who say, oh, you can't give me a mandate, but I'm going to give you my honest bias. If you earn over $75,000 a year and you don't have health insurance, we should either require you to get insurance or to post a bond. Now, if you want to post a bond, fine. But this idea that you're earning over $75,000 a year, you decided you need a second home or a third car, and you're going to take the risk that all of your neighbors are going to kick in to take care of you, I think is immoral. And I'm prepared just to draw a line and say, that's not about liberty. That's about being a freeloader. Now, I'm willing to give you the choice of not buying insurance. We ought to figure out what is a reasonable standard for emergency care, including cancer, including car wrecks, including strokes, and say, fine, if you'll post that amount as a bond, don't buy insurance. We don't care. But this idea, I think, and I'm sure some of you, we can have a nice debate in a minute. I don't see how you can argue, unless you're prepared to be a true libertarian and say, look, if I don't have any insurance and I show up, they shouldn't have to take care of me. No, you know that's not going to happen. But I'd be happy for somebody to say, it's okay to let me die by the side of the road because I want to exercise my right to be totally stupid. That's at least a real libertarian argument. But I don't find many people exactly into that once they get sick. So I think we're going to have to grow up a lot in the next 10 years as a country. We've had a long stretch here of kidding ourselves. And I think what we've seen happen with housing and what we've seen happen on Wall Street is just the beginning. I think we're going to have a huge shakeout in government in the next 10 years. I don't think California is sustainable. I was telling them earlier, I don't think I said this to you all as a group, but I'll close with this. Just to give you an idea of the scale of change. In 2002, the California Highway Patrol had 82% of their retirements on disability. Now, that's fraud. It's ripping off the people of California. And when your police are doing it, can you imagine what your non-police are willing to do? And we as a country are just going to have to face reality. We're at the end of the long feast where we could be sloppy and stupid, and it didn't matter because we were so big we could get away with it. We're about to re-enter the real world. And housing and Wall Street were the beginning, and health has to be an integral part of that, and that means a fairly large number of changes from individual responsibility to a healthy community to a truly productive and effective delivery system to a process of insurance that gives every American a chance to be part of the system. So it's a sweeping overview, and if it's okay, I'm going to toss it open for questions. And see, I think you have a microphone, right? So this gentleman right here.
We're looking for that money to fall out of the system to help us do something here. But we're befuddled without federal change because the Medicare, Medicaid requirements, both in terms of documentation, administrative costs, and their low reimbursement rates, are sopping up that excess. So barring any federal change, how are we going to find some extra dollars here?
Well, I think you have a slightly harder job here because of the efficiency of the local system. I mean, I think you're already a lower cost system than a lot of places. But having said that, I do think there are some things you could do at the individual level and the community level that would, in fact, lower the long-term cost trajectory. I also believe that would be very helpful if you took the local system model and you came back both through your state legislature adopting resolutions and your members of Congress, and you said exactly what you just said, which is show me the replacement model on Medicare and the replacement model on Medicaid that gets us to a 21st century intelligent health system for those two areas, and let us, we'll be glad to pick up the fight at the center, and with your delegation helping, And if your state legislature were to adopt it and send it to other states, you know, because I think we've got to start this idea, we're going to actually fix things, not just complain about them. So I would love to know what the right system would be as opposed to what the wrong system is, and I'd be very eager to help fight to pass the right system. And you're right, it'll take a little while, but that's how this country operates. I mean, we passed welfare reform when I was Speaker. It took us years to get it through, and 65% of the people in welfare either went to school or went to work. I mean, fact is, over time, we passed huge change, and it worked. Okay. Yes, ma'am. I think he's going to bring you a microphone.
I'm thrilled to hear that you want a uniform information system across the whole country. How do you propose to make each proprietary system give up their ownership of their own information? Because it saves them a lot of money to have a system that works. But to give it up and share it is not a thought that actually becomes them.
Well, I think in the long run, and which maybe if I can pull it off, will be next year. I think, first of all, we ought to adopt rules towards interoperability. We ought to recognize that that's going to require some workarounds, but they're an increasing capacity to move towards interoperable systems. And I think that has to be a primary goal. And we also have to say, and again, this may lead to some controversy, I think your personal health record ultimately belongs to you. I think your hospital can have a copy, your insurance can have a copy, your doctor's office can have a copy. But I think over your lifetime, particularly, you know, think about somebody who's about to be born or who's going to be born in the next 2 or 3 years. Between genetic data and everything else that's coming down the road, they may live to be 90 or 100 years old. They may move 35 times in their lifetime. And the idea that they leave a little record over here and a little record over here and a little record over here, it's just crazy. So I think you're going to ultimately have some kind of utility system and some ability to have interoperability. We do it with telephones all the time. We do it with television waves. I mean, you know, we've learned over a long period of time to standardize. You can go anywhere in the U.S. and plug an electric razor in or plug in your computer, and the electric circuit works. So we know how to do this. What you've had is, institution by institution, highly siloed, overly consulted, proprietary systems that essentially have operated in what I think is makes perfect sense for individual institutions, but is fundamentally wrong for the society at large.
Government regulation to create an
interoperable? Sure, of course, just as you've had. But the government member doesn't have to run it and doesn't have to have a bureaucracy in charge of it. In 1916, the Congress established an Electrical Standards Commission, which is run by the private sector, which sets the standards for all of your appliances. And they meet regularly, and it's totally dominated by engineers. It has no bureaucracy and no politics, but it makes sure that the standard for electrical systems are up to a technical standard. And that was really necessary, because otherwise you'd have 22 different standards.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you comment on tort reform and how that would be implemented in your plan, or how you would approach that with our current spending structure and the overutilization, please?
Well, look, I think that there are two things you want to emphasize with the right to sue. The first is the equity protection of the individual in situations where they've been grievously harmed, and the second is the pursuit of justice and a system which actually has as its goal finding the truth and finding a fair solution. What has happened since 1963, when the court dramatically expanded the grounds for suit, is a grotesque distortion of the law. Trial lawyers today are an industry. They're not a profession. They operate like an industry. They plan strategies. They create lawsuits. They go out and invent customers. I would adopt several things. First of all, as a cultural matter, I would reverse the court decision on allowing lawyers to sue. I mean, I can't imagine anything, allowing lawyers to advertise. I can't imagine anything more destructive than, I don't know how many of you ever watch in the middle of the afternoon, you know, the advertisement that comes on that basically says, do you know somebody with money? Do you think under some circumstance you ought to have some of it? why don't you drop by for a free consultation on who you might be able to rip off? I mean, just watch these ads. They are invitations to greed, envy, and conflict. They're the opposite of a healthy society. Second, I think that you have to have the classes. Class actions ought to involve true classes. You now have class invention. You know, I got something the other day that said that I bought a washer dryer which it had a technical problem, which basically justified my being part of a class action lawsuit, as a result of which the net result would probably have been I would have gotten a T-shirt. But the law firm would have gotten one-third of the money for the whole class. I mean, it is the manufacturing of grievance for the purpose of enabling trial lawyers to buy baseball teams. That's fundamentally antithetical to any kind of free market society that has a decent sense of self-respect for itself. So I'd be for fairly substantial reform. The two places we've worked on, and Wayne Oliver at the center works on this regularly. We've worked in Texas, where Dr. John Gill spent 7 years as part of a coalition, and they not only rewrote tort law, they wrote it into the Texas state constitution because they didn't trust the Supreme Court, which was made up of lawyers who they presumed and eventually would be pro-trial lawyer. So they literally have now written these things into the Texas state constitution. They've been averaging 4,000 lawyers a year moving into Texas as a result of this having passed. They've had a dramatic decline in lawsuits filed. I was in Oklahoma recently, and the doctors or the hospital in Oklahoma was complaining that their doctors were migrating to Texas and the Texas trial lawyers were migrating to Oklahoma. They said it's the worst of all worlds. We now have, you know, both things are happening at once. The other example is Missouri, which has adopted some fairly significant rules, one of which is the way in which judges are selected. So you no longer have jurisdiction shopping by the trial lawyers to try to find a place where they'll win. So there are things like that that I think do make a difference, and we think that tort reform is a significant component. It's not a single magic, but it is a significant component of a healthy system of delivering health care. See, here.
I'll just, is that working? I'll just answer back to this question here. We do have an all-payer system database that we are gathering information. We do have a clinical information exchange setting up a standard for data for communication electronically so that we're talking interoperability, common language. My question, however, deals with we're looking to put up a portal in the state of Utah, much like a billboard, so to speak, but allowing individuals both access for information, product comparison, and if they elect to, even access to the insurance company's website for purchase. Wonder if that fits into the model around the country you've got, how that fits in or access or where it would fit.
Well, I think it's useful to some degree. I mean, what I have not been able to figure out yet is how you create the same level of transparency with insurance purchasing that we want to get with price and quality for doctors, hospitals, medical devices, prescription drugs. First of all, because most insurance contracts are written in a form which guarantees you'll never have a clue what they mean. And so you've got to really, but we ought to be really thinking about what would you put on a portal that would allow me to make comparative decisions. You know, if you look at Travelocity, which is clearly a simpler model, but you can go to Travelocity and look up every airline flight between two cities all day long and the prices, and whichever class you want to choose, whether it's first class or coach, and whether it's, you know, 30-day pre-purchase or staying over Saturday night. I mean, it's amazing the number of permutations that Travelocity and Obits and similar systems have, Hotel.com. So I would say to make it, I mean, there are two great advantages. First of all, you're lowering the barrier to me learning that I can get insurance. I think that's a good thing. And second, ideally, you're giving me a better informed range of choices about what's available. But there are at least two or three firms. Dave Merritt, who's here, standing right back there, and Dave does our information technology at the center. He was pointing out there are two or three firms that already do this at a national level to some extent that you can go to buy online. And you probably ought to really consult intensely with them and try to figure out what are the actual inhibitions to doing this. The other challenge you're going to get to is, ultimately, you've got to figure out what do you do for the person who literally can't afford it. I mean, do you figure out some way to offer a bare-bones package that at least guarantees against the most probable conditions, or what? Because I do think we have a problem. In Massachusetts, I think they're discovering that they had a bigger appetite for change in their wallet, and Massachusetts was uniquely positioned because they had a very expensive Medicaid program, and so they could afford to buy in the hospitals, and they could afford to spend a lot of money. Romney told me at the time he didn't think there was any other state in the country that could have afforded their program. And so you got to be careful about how do you set it up so it's sustainable over time. But I think the concept is a good one, and I really commend you for developing it.
Mr. Gingrich? Oh.
Yes, sir.
Do you have opinion about the Wyden-Bennett bill?
I don't know enough about it in detail to comment.
Under current projections, the Medicare costs that are facing this country is capable of bankrupting the country at some point in the future. What's your response to that? How do we deal with that issue?
Well, I mean, my conclusion, in the handout we gave you, I think it's on page 2, we have sort of our key rules for how you deal with the challenge of change. And I partly developed this over a long period of time. It's page 2. I first got briefed on the problem of Medicare in 1981, early in the Reagan administration, when Dave Stockman did a projection of percent of GDP by topic. And when you added up all the different things, what you knew was the system wouldn't work the way it was going to. When I became speaker, we had a commitment to balance the federal budget, and I ended up, I think for the only time in history, I personally chaired a Medicare reform committee which combined the senior members of Energy and Commerce and the senior members of Ways and Means, and I led the project which in 1996 passed Medicare reform. And we did so with AARP staying neutral, even though we were an election year with a liberal Democrat in the White House. So it was a very complicated project. One of the reasons we founded the Center for Health Transformation is captured in this page. I don't believe you solve Medicare unless you solve the health system. I don't believe you solve the health system unless you transform it in the four-box model I described. And I don't think you transform the delivery system unless you move towards a health-based health reform or you go to rationing. And that's why I said earlier, if we don't find a smart way to solve this, we will find a stupid way to solve it. So it's important to remember that this is, you're dealing with a government which on a bad day can be stunningly dumb. And so you'd like to get it solved faster than they can be dumb. Or they will be, because they'll run out of money. So having said that, there are a couple of keys here. One is the Einstein provision, that doing more of what you're already doing and expecting a different result is a sign of insanity. And there are a number of steps I would take with Medicare, some of which would be designed, frankly, to liberate senior citizens and allow them to spend their own money. I mean, I do not understand why we would say to Bill Gates, he can't pay extra if he wants to. But technically, Medicare is a more closed system than the British National Health Service. So one step would be to inject more cash in by making it voluntary. I mean, if people who are successful want to spend more, why not allow them to? The second thing I'd look at, though, is migrating Medicare away from acute care towards prevention and wellness and trying to manage these conditions, and also moving it away from transactions towards processes. I mean, I don't want to know. I'll give you an example. It's another South Florida story. An acquaintance of mine has two parents who both have Alzheimer's. They're at a very early stage. They visit their doctor every day. And their doctor loves seeing them every day. And they chat with him every day. And then he's had a visit. And they're delighted. They think it's terrific. Now, it's not medical, but he gets to bill. They get to drop by. Everything's fine. Again, why are we doing that? And you'll find when you go to, and by the way, I mentioned to you earlier about fraud. Specific example that came up recently in Medicare, which was a doctor who filed for 4 colonoscopies on the same person in one day. To which my response was, I hope that was fraud. But I think unless, Your only two long-term trajectories are to move towards a better system of greater productivity with greater health, where individuals have more responsibility for themselves, or to move towards a system where we bureaucratically start rationing. Those are the only two strategies on a large order that I can see for where we are.
Well,
and I think I've now had the hook.
No, I haven't had the hook. We just want to be respectful of your busy schedule. Let me thank you for the considerable energy and intellect that you bring to this most important conversation in America, and specifically for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us traveling a long distance. Please join me in thanking again Peter Gingrich. Newt has most graciously agreed to meet with some members of the media, and that will be in the boardroom over here on the east side of the building. So media members, if you'd like to meet with him over there. And again, let me express our gratitude for all of you for joining us and participating in these ongoing discussions, these healthy dialogues. We'll look forward to seeing you in the future.